On the show today, an arrest made in Ukraine after a restaurant was targeted by Russian missiles.
The man filmed the restaurant for the Russians and informed them about its popularity.
Plus, Ugandan refugees are struggling amid climate change.
In Uganda's Palorinya refugee camp, gardens are filled with corn, but there will be little to harvest. Father of nine, Eid Alfred, says in the past his garden yielded 2 bags of corn, but with the prolonged drought this year, he expects nothing.
And later, a preview of the EU summit and a new way to calculate your age in South Korea. Everyone there gets younger. Today is Thursday, June 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. Ukraine's counterintelligence service said on Wednesday that it's arrested a man it's suspected of helping Russia direct a missile attack that hit a popular pizza restaurant in Kramatorsk, killed at least 11 people and wounded another 61. AP correspondent Charles Della Desma has that story.
Ukraine's security service writes in a Telegram post, the man filmed the restaurant for the Russians and informed them about its popularity, but officials have not provided any evidence for this claim. Russia has insisted during the war that it doesn't aim at civilian targets, although its airstrikes have killed many civilians. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov repeated the claim on Wednesday. Ukrainian-held parts of the partially occupied Donetsk province have been hit especially hard by Russian bombardments and are a key barrier to resolving the war. I'm Charles Della Desma.
The Biden administration says the brief weekend uprising in Russia clearly weakened Russian President Vladimir Putin. AP correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
President Biden says the question is, to what extent?
It's hard to tell, but he's clearly losing the war.
And has become a global pariah. But what comes next?
This is a moving picture, and I don't think we've seen the last act.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken tells the Council on Foreign Relations the uprising underlies Putin's complete failure in Ukraine, but he notes the biggest roadblock to negotiating a peaceful end to the war remains Putin's mindset that he can outlast both Kyiv and all of us.
The more we're able to disabuse him of that notion, the more likely it is that at some point he'll come to the table.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
And the drama following the rebellion by Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner Group, continues. On Wednesday, media reported that General Sergei Surovikin, the head of the Russian Aerospace Forces, and until January, Moscow's supreme commander in Ukraine, has not been seen in public since Saturday. The New York Times reported on Tuesday that Surovikin had advanced knowledge of Prigozhin's plans, although in a video posted to the messaging app Telegram, he condemned the rebellion and urged the Wagner militia members to return to their bases. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty reports that Surovikin worked closely with Prigozhin during Russia's intervention in the Syrian civil war, which began in 2015. European leaders face several hot-button issues when they meet Thursday and Friday in Brussels, from Russia's war on Ukraine and Russia rocked by the Wagner revolt to relations with China and EU immigration policy following the horrific sinking of a migrant ship off the coast of Greece. VOA's Lisa Bryans has more.
Wagner head Yevgeny Prigozhin's uprising last weekend has added a new element of instability for the EU when it comes to the war in Ukraine, with Eastern European countries especially worried about Wagner mercenaries moving to nearby Belarus. The Brussels summit also comes ahead of a key NATO summit in Vilnius next month. Kyiv is pushing for a so-called political invitation to join the transatlantic alliance. EU member Sweden also hopes to join NATO as early as July. At a meeting earlier this week of EU foreign ministers, the bloc's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, said the revolt in Russia makes Europe's support for Ukraine even more important.
Because what has happened during this weekend shows that the wind against Ukraine is cracking Russian power and affecting its political system.
EU member states agreed last week to strengthen sanctions against Russia, including a measure that would make it possible to punish countries that help Moscow to avoid them. The Kremlin says it will retaliate with more travel bans. Judy Dempsey is the editor of the Strategic Europe blog for the Carnegie Europe Policy Institute.
The EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, a German, has been steadfast in her support, financial, political and social support for Ukraine, and particularly for its president, Zelensky.
The Ukraine war has also revived longstanding calls, especially by France, to beef up the EU's own defense capabilities, including by jointly procuring military supplies. That will also be on the table in Brussels. A new Munich Security Conference report criticizes the EU defense capacity and cooperation, faulting a lack of leadership by countries like France and Germany. Analyst Dempsey is also critical.
But there's an awareness by some of the European member states that Europe really has to boost its own capabilities and security capabilities as well to actually defend their own territories and backyards. But the record on that is miserable.
Another tricky summit topic, relations with China, which both Brussels and Washington say they want to de-risk without breaking ties. China's new premier, Li Qiang, visited European capitals this month amid EU concerns of economic dependence on Beijing, including for its green energy transition. Again, Carnegie's Dempsey.
There's no doubt that this charm offensive that the Chinese are doing now in Europe is all about dividing the Americans from the Europeans, dividing the Europeans among themselves, between themselves.
There's another divisive issue, migration. Leaders at the Brussels summit will discuss expanding controversial deals with countries like Tunisia to stem migration. Critics say that won't fix the problem. Backdropping the discussions is the sinking of a migrant vessel off Greece earlier this month that killed hundreds of people. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And on the subject of international diplomacy, politicians from the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance are meeting in Wellington, New Zealand, where migration and security top the agenda. The Five Eyes Alliance includes the United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Phil Mercer reports.
The Five Eyes Alliance is an intelligence sharing accord among five English-speaking democracies. British Home Secretary Suella Braverman is among those attending meetings in Wellington, New Zealand. The war in Ukraine and China's growing assertiveness are expected to be discussed at the five-country ministerial talks Wednesday in Wellington. Also on the agenda in the New Zealand capital are cybersecurity, child sex abuse, and foreign espionage at universities. Delegates are also expected to discuss migration and labour mobility schemes between alliance countries. Anne-Marie Brady is a professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at New Zealand's University of Canterbury. She told VOA Wednesday that the Five Eyes Alliance has an important part to play in maintaining global security.
Because the rules-based international order is under such threat by the behaviour of Russia and China and the way they misuse their positions in international organisations such as the Security Council, that is leading to an increasing prominence of groupings of interested states. That relationship of the five countries and Five Eyes is very important and relevant in a very challenging international environment.
The Five Eyes Alliance began between the United States and Britain in the aftermath of the Second World War. Over the next decade, it was expanded to include Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. It has had a reputation for secrecy. Earlier this year, it blamed China for recent cyber attacks targeting critical infrastructure in the US. Beijing responded by accusing the English-speaking grouping of spreading disinformation. New Zealand Prime Minister Chris Hipkins has been in China this week on an official visit. Tuesday, he met Chinese President Xi Jinping. Both leaders acknowledged the importance of the bilateral relationship. they discussed trade, international relations, and the war in Ukraine. Hipkin said in a statement that his country's relationship with China is one of our most significant and wide-ranging. New Zealand's exports to China are worth more than $12.8 billion, or a quarter of the country's total export earnings, according to government data. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And here are some more stories we're working on from around the world. 4 months into a social media ban, communications businesses and civil rights groups in Ethiopia are feeling the impact. Strict regulations are making it harder for them to reach audiences or verify information. 5 years after the single worst attack on U.S. media in history, the city of Annapolis, Maryland, still honors the lives lost at the Capital Gazette newspaper. A blistering new report by the UN Human Rights Office shows that Ukrainian civilians have been arbitrarily detained by both warring parties, although the Russian Federation is guilty of most of the crimes and cases of abuse. Deforestation rates are at a near record low in Indonesia, home to the world's third largest rainforests. It's one of the few bright spots in an otherwise grim annual report on the loss of forests worldwide. This is VOA News.
VOA Science Beat. Scientists have created embryo models to help study the mysteries of early human development, the medical problems before birth, and why many pregnancies fail. These models are created from stem cells and not egg and sperm, which can't grow into babies. Using models avoids the controversy of using real embryos in research. Real human embryos can be extremely hard to see at that stage because they burrow into the uterus. For the model, scientists use stem cells, which are capable of developing into many different types of cells or tissues in the body. Several groups are working on the models, including two that published studies in the journal Nature. Other scientists published work in June that hasn't been reviewed by peers. I'm VOA's Steve Miller.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. We'll find out why everyone in South Korea just got younger in a few minutes. But now, plans by a United Nations agency to cut food aid starting July 1st for refugees in Uganda, Africa's biggest refugee host, are expected to worsen their struggle with food shortages from climate change. The UN's World Food Program says aid cuts leave them no choice but to help only the most vulnerable. Halima Athumani reports from the Palorina refugee camp in the Obongi district of Uganda.
In Uganda's Palorina refugee camp, gardens are filled with corn, but there will be little to harvest. Father of nine, Eid Alfred, says in the past his garden yielded 2 bags of corn, but with the prolonged drought this year, he expects nothing. He says, when you look at these crops, they are not drought resistant. They need constant rain for a good harvest. Without rain, he says, I won't get anything. They will die completely. The UN's refugee agency says Uganda is home to more than 1.5 million refugees and asylum seekers, making it the largest host in Africa. Uganda's government provides each family with a 9-by-9-meter plot for a house and a small garden. But it's not enough to survive for refugee families like mother of five, Naima Poni, who treks to the border with South Sudan to buy food.
The food is very little. My children is now growing. They're eating too much. Even though no food, food is not enough.
The UN says it has only received 27% of the funding needed for refugees in Uganda, so it has been forced to switch for the first time to targeted assistance from July 1st. Households considered most vulnerable, such as those headed by women or the chronically ill, will receive 60% of the recommended monthly food ration. Other refugees will get just 30%. The World Food Programme's Deputy Director for Uganda, Marcus Pryor, says officials will keep a close watch for serious negative impacts from the food cuts.
We'll look at things like people's food consumption, we'll look at malnutrition rates, we'll look at the kind of survival strategies that refugees resort to if they are in difficulties. And this will allow us to take our case to those who support the World Food Programme and the refugee response more broadly.
Refugee leader Kenyi Moses says he is already seeing an impact from the drought and food aid cuts. Some refugees are leaving.
Most of our households right now, they were on the left in the hands of younger
children. He says most of our households right now were left in the hands of young children. He says most of our people have gone back to South Sudan, well knowing the situation there is not favorable. He says these children alone cannot be heads of the family. The World Food Programme in Uganda says it needs at least $64 million to support the refugees until the end of the year. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Palorinya Refugee Camp in Obongi District, Uganda.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Japan has accepted about 2,300 Ukrainians under the status of evacuees. This is an unprecedented number for a country that in 2021 accepted just 74 refugees from around the world. Yulia Yarmarenko tells the story of one Ukrainian family in Japan.
Oksana and Natalia Paramonova came to Japan from Ukraine in January 2023. Natalia Paramonova is from the Ukrainian city of Shostka in the Sumy region that was repeatedly shelled by Russian forces.
I was in a very poor psychological state. Oksana came to Ukraine from Italy and took me away. She said, Mama, we need to leave and get better. Her dad, my husband, stayed at home.
Mother and daughter received evacuee status because Natalia Paramonova's younger daughter lives in Japan. They're among around 2,300 Ukrainians who came to Japan since the start of the full-scale war in 2022. Japan accepted only 74 refugees in 2021. Sergei Korsunsky, Ukraine's ambassador to Japan, says the main condition for coming to Japan is to have a sponsor, usually a relative, a close friend, a company, or a university. The rest is up to Japan's government.
Today, you'll find Ukrainians everywhere, from Hokkaido to Okinawa. Every prefecture and mayor's office has a special center for helping Ukrainian evacuees. Evacuees get accommodation. Kids go to school. Parents get permission to work. They also get medical insurance, same as the Japanese themselves have.
The Paramonovas live in the suburbs of Tokyo and only pay utility bills. Oksana says she feels the support from locals.
There is a belief that Japan is a very closed community, that people don't open up easily. But when we settled here, I told my mom it felt like home. It's cozy and the people are so open.
Support centers for Ukrainians also help. One such center is Himavari. Its founder is psychologist Mariko Ukiyo, who specializes in helping people who have lived through trauma.
I cannot stop the war. Even the American president can't stop it. But what I can do is help those people who came to Japan with psychological trauma they need to deal with.
But the trauma is not just psychological. Many Ukrainians come to Japan with a medical history. Oksana Paramonova is fighting an oncological disease, and Ukiyo, who also has cancer, helped the woman find a good doctor and assisted with communication. Meanwhile, 18-year-old Robert, who declined to give his last name, has been living in Japan for the last 9 months. The center helped him find a job and learn Japanese. Robert's dream is to get a degree in aircraft engineering and see his family members who stayed in Ukraine.
I've been living abroad for 18 months now, and I miss them terribly.
Natalia Paramonova says she intends to go back to Ukraine once the war is over to help rebuild her home country. But for now, she's teaching her Japanese neighbors how to make borscht while making new friends. Yulia Yarmolenko for VOA News, Tokyo, Japan.
They say age ain't nothing but a number, but it all depends on where you start counting. And in South Korea, that's changed. Reuters' Olivia Chan has more.
South Koreans became a year or two younger on Wednesday. New laws that require using only the international method of counting age took effect, replacing the country's traditional method. This was how the traditional age system works. People are deemed to be a year old at birth, and a year is added every January 1st. Since the early 1960s, the country has used the international norm of calculating from zero at birth and adding a year on every birthday for medical and legal documents. But many South Koreans continue to use the traditional method for everything else. Some, like Choi Hun-ji, are happy to be, quote, younger again.
I'm supposed to be 30 next year in the traditional Korean age system, but with this new age system, I became 2 years younger. It's just great to feel like you're getting younger, and I feel a bit of distance from becoming 30. I'm so happy that I can celebrate this year's birthday once again in a younger age.
According to a government survey conducted in September 2022, 86% of South Koreans said they would use the international age in their everyday life when the new laws took effect. Minister of Government Legislation Lee Won-kyo said on Monday, they expect legal disputes, complaints, and social confusion to be greatly reduced. Another age system exists in South Korea for conscription, school entrance, and calculating the legal age to drink alcohol and smoke. A person's age is calculated from zero at birth, and a year is added on January 1st. Officials said that method would remain for the time being.
Reuters' Olivia Chan reporting for us. And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to holding the perpetrators of sexual violence accountable and to backing countries to deliver the long overdue justice that the victims and survivors deserve, said United States Representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield. Conflict-related sexual violence is prevalent around the world. Russian soldiers in Ukraine, gang members in Haiti, armed groups in Sudan, South Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo are using gender-based violence, including sexual violence, to terrorize and control populations with impunity. Some of the most egregious crimes against humanity, particularly gender-based violence against women and girls, were committed by the ISIS terrorist group against Iraq's Yazidi community. On August 3, 2014, ISIS militants invaded the Yazidi homeland and began a reign of terror. They murdered the men and boys and took the women and girls as sex slaves. Yazidi women were raped, degraded, tortured, and murdered, bought and sold like cattle. On June 20th, the U.S. Department of State designated two ISIS leaders as specially designated global terrorists under Executive Order 13224. They are Arkan Ahmad Abbas al-Matuti, also known as Abu Sarhan, a senior field military commander in the town of Wilayat al-Jazira, and Nawaf Ahmad Alwan al-Rashidi, or Abu Faris, an ISIS financial manager and smuggler. At the same time, the Department of State and the Treasury Department Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated pursuant to Executive Order 13664 two high-ranking officials of South Sudan for their involvement in abductions of South Sudanese women and girls and conflict-related sexual violence. James Nando is a major general in South Sudan's People's Defense Forces. In 2021, forces loyal to Nando were responsible for at least 64 instances of rape and sexual slavery against civilians in western Equatoria. In 2018, Nanda was responsible for the abduction of hundreds of women and girls. Also in 2018, forces under the command of Alfred Fatuyo, currently the governor of Western Equatoria, carried out numerous attacks there that resulted in the abduction of 887 civilians, of whom at least 43 were raped. The United States does not accept conflict-related sexual violence as an inevitable cost of armed conflict, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a written statement. We remain committed to supporting survivor-centered and trauma-informed approaches to helping survivors access the services needed to help them recover and secure the justice they deserve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.